Welcome to the Reaction Podcast. I'm Francesca Peacock, introducing the best of the conversations from the Reaction editors and guests in the last week. Most of our discussions on politics, economics, and culture are now also available to watch on our YouTube channel. This week, editor Ian Martin spoke to MP Andrew Mitchell about his new book, Beyond a Fringe, Tales from a Reformed Establishment Lackey. The full discussion about Andrew's life in the parliamentary jungle is available on our YouTube channel. But here is a snippet.
It's a very unusual book. We'll get to why that is the case in a few minutes. But why did you write it now?
Well, it's all the fault of your colleague, the senior journalist, Michael Crick, who at the start of lockdown said to me, how are you going to fill the long evenings while your wife is doctoring in the NHS in London, and you're looking after your constituents in the Midlands? And he said to me, why don't you write a book, and why don't you put in it all those funny stories you've told me down the years about whipping and about Boris Johnson? Because if you don't do it, I'm going to stick it in my own diaries. So I said, after a bit of, you know, to-ing and fro-ing, I said to him, well, look, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll write those two chapters, the chapter on whipping, which I've entitled Whipping Like Stripping is Best Done in Private, and the chapter on Boris, which is my role in his ascent. Anyway, then unbeknownst to me, he sent these two chapters that I sent to him to his agent. And it rest all sort of followed from that. And I nervously wrote the rest of it, and the agent liked it. And then Bite Back decided they'd like to publish it. So it all really came from that.
So you've been cabinet minister, been at the top of UK politics for a long time, seen a lot, and we'll come to all of that. Boris, we'll also discuss the Plebgate scandal as well, and there's a really interesting chapter at the end as well on lessons learned. But let's go right back to the beginning, Andrew Mitchell, before you were an MP. I mean, in terms of upbringing, it's a very funny portrait of school, of university, and the army. It really is a very, very amusing and quite affecting read. But it does come across, also with the family background, the family business, is that it's a quintessentially English establishment upbringing, isn't it?
It is, and I'm sort of quite clear about that. I say right at the very beginning that mine has been a privileged life, and it has. And, you know, the subtitle is Tales from a Reformed Establishment Lackey. And what struck me was that I have been a member of almost all the sort of establishment bodies in Britain. I mean, I haven't been a member, obviously, of the monarchy, but everything else pretty well is there, from prep school to rugby, to the army, to Cambridge, to the City of London, to Parliament and to the Cabinet and to the Privy Council. So all of that struck me as being of interest. But all those organisations, all of them, have changed almost out of all recognition during my lifetime. So I wanted to sort of describe that. And you're very kind about my school days. But, you know, looking back on it, it was quite extraordinary, you know, that the sort of British upper middle classes paid good money to send their children away to be abused at school. And, you know, Alex Renton, who's the son of an MP, has written a book about my prep school, which is replete with horror and anger. And so I write with some care, because although I don't think it did me much damage, my wife, a doctor, would probably disagree with that. But I think it, for a lot of people, it did do them an awful lot of damage in life. But, you know, I've been a member of all those groups. I'm not for a moment suggesting that I'm not still a member of the establishment, or Ian, you'd roar with laughter and say, of course you are. But I am a much more cynical member of the establishment, and I think a more realistic member, because when I first became a member of Parliament, I very much wanted to be part of that establishment. But today, I'm much more sceptical, and I mean, I can't deny I'm a part of it, but I'm a country member.
That's a very English establishment way of phrasing it, describing yourself as a country member. But there's a wonderful story of you, and I think Adair Turner read Adair sometimes described, going on a speaking tour, a debating tour of the United States, and trying to do your English sort of debating shtick in front of, I think, a thousand Christian students. And the proposition is...
Yes, that's right. We were very, I mean, he and I have to say, were very arrogant, because we offered our American hosts 10 debating subjects, which were mainly designed to provoke them. And we offered to speak on either side. And so we had the motion, I think, that Christianity is an elaborate superstition. And we offered to speak on either side. And we were asked to speak in favor of the motion in Colorado. We turned up and there were 1,000 members of the Christian Union there. And I sort of made my jokes and put the case for Christianity being an elaborate superstition. And the person on the other side of the debate, when he stood up, the first thing he said is, before I demolish all Andrew's arguments and Adair's, I want us to pray for their immortal souls. And at the end of the debate, I think we got 5 votes. I think they were pity votes. They were pity votes. They weren't sort of supporting. The other 995 voted against us.
And then the army, the city, really good chapter on Lazard describing that. I sometimes write books about financial history, and I'm fascinated by the history of the city and the culture of that period. But what you describe is it is extraordinary that Britain made any money at all in the 1960s and 1970s.
Yeah, I mean, the first Lazard never made, and the city people never made real money until much later. The first time Lazard made money actually was when John Knott returned from politics, yes, went back to the city, came into Lazard as a director of Lazard, and very quickly became the chairman. And that was the point where Lazard started making money, partly because of the brilliant people that he recruited, but also because of the different types of business he set up. But before Big Bang, no one talked about their salaries and remuneration. For example, in Lazard, it was a sackable offence to talk about your salary to another employee. You didn't poach other people's clients, or if they came to you, you rang up the person from whom they'd come to sort of rather embarrassedly apologise for pinching their clients. And of course, when the Americans came and Big Bang happened, the whole thing was blown apart. And because, a lot of these businesses didn't have much capital and didn't make much money, the Americans were very easily able to buy them up. And so the system of the merchant banks, the accepting houses into which I went in 1979, that was all sort of blown away. And in fact, of the accepting houses then, the only two that are left, I think now, are Rothschilds and Lazard. And that was mainly because they only did advisory work, and they didn't want John Knott kept us out of, the buying a money-based, a capital-based entity. And so those are the only two that really have survived. That's because they did advisory work, basically. They had no balance sheets.
Yeah. No, John Knott, was really a transformative force in the city. So politics. Why politics? You'll be asked this question a lot, but... was it just an assumption that you would do it? I mean, you were obviously interested in political ideas. You were interested in how power worked. I mean, what was it that made you think, right, I'm going to give up what would have been an extremely profitable career carrying on staying in the city in one form or another and decide instead to become an MP?
Well, I've had a father who was in the House of Commons, so I've been able to see the pluses and minuses of politics at one remove. And when I've been at Cambridge, I've been very fortunate. I've been president of the Cambridge Union. I've been chairman of the Cambridge University Conservative Association. And so I mean, it was in my blood, I think. But when I left university, I thought I should forget about politics and go and get a proper job. And I spent very interesting times at Lazard in the early years working with British exporters, trying to win big ticket projects against the Japanese and the Germans and the French and Italians and Americans and so forth. And I saw the decline in Britain, which Mrs. Thatcher started to put right at that time. And then I think largely did put right. So I was never sort of not aware of politics. And I used to shout at the television screen and when things were going wrong under Labour beforehand. And people said to me, well, instead of shouting at television, why don't you do something about it? So it was sort of a mixture of, I think, it in my blood and also, you know, irritation of what was going on. But I sort of confess in the book that I wasn't ideologically driven. I mean, I was a conservative because I thought the conservatives ran the country better. They managed it better. And I didn't really believe in anything very deeply at that stage in my career. But I've come latterly to believe deeply in things and to really care about some of the things that our government is doing and some of the things they're not doing. So I've come, if you like, I've come to ideological belief quite late. Most people have ideological belief and then go into politics. I'd rather think I was the other way around.
And now, here is Press Review, the show where the reaction editors and guests discuss the stories from across the world that caught their attention this week. Ian was joined by Mark Fox and Maggie Pagano to discuss everything from the Tory sleaze row to interest rates. Here is the whole show.
So shall we kick off first with really just an overview of the Paterson story, Mark? I mean, this is hugely damaging to the Conservative Party. Been raging all week, still not done. I think I counted about 12 pages in the Daily Mail plus a leader this morning. How serious is the damage to the Tories?
So I think there are three different strands here. At the heart of all this, it's a human being, right? And there's a human being who has suffered significant degree of personal as well as professional hiatus. And I'm not going to get into making judgments about who's done what and where and all the rest of it. I'm just saying there's a human being. And we need to think about that. Because obviously, as we all know, politics is a contact sport. It's the roughest and toughest arena for activity, and that's how it is, because that's why we don't go and fight on the streets. So anybody who goes into politics, it's important to say, knows what they're signing up for. I've tried it myself, so I'm not just sitting on a back bench sort of spouting. You know, you bust a gut to get into politics, you know you're into a rough and tough arena. So the issues are serious, because this is more than just about what Mr. Paterson did and didn't do. This has been going on for a very long time, and has been rumbling away for months, actually, and has been like a running sore inside the parliamentary party. That's the first thing to say. I think my own view is that the system does need reform and updating, because it was established a while ago. But as Sir Peter Bottomley, the father of the House of Commons, who I wrote a bit about yesterday,
in reaction,
said rightly, actually, that you need to disaggregate the two things, the personal, the specific to Mr. Paterson, and the need for reform of the process. And I think that was how these judgments came to be put in front of the Prime Minister to make is a quite a serious thing about the running of the parliamentary party. And I think that's going to need some thinking about. There's lots of people blaming the chief whip and all sorts of individual parliamentary colleagues. But there's a sort of a something here about a collective view of the world and a judgment that should sort of inform how the conduct is undertaken. And that sort of seems to be a bit wobbly at the moment.
Yeah.
And the third thing is, you know, whatever the rights and wrongs, Ian and Maggie, there's no doubt that this morning the Prime Minister, who was having a good COP week and had come off the back of a good reshuffle and had come off the back of a good budget where it was clearly his budget, but it was his budget in political terms. He got what he wanted. And he was getting what he wanted out of COP and all this. He was having on a bit of a role politically, good polling results, has now just slammed straight into a brick wall. And he's got a serious problem with his parliamentary party from all wings. So I would say to you, Ian, I think it's quite a moment for him, right? It's
so
quite
take, a moment. Yeah, so let's flag up the front of the Mail. To some of our younger viewers, this is a newspaper. You chop down trees, print on it. Actually, really, really good piece of technology.
Not eco-friendly, though, Ian. So,
in the old school. Of course,
you had to mention that. Now, so it's not actually the splash, but it's a huge kind of graphic presentation at the top. It says pages 8 to 13. Is anybody in charge at number 10 on a day of fast? Tories U-turn over disgraced MP Paterson. after public fury, he quits. And Maggie, there's an account in that from Andrew Pearce, a journalist we all know, who really knows his Westminster and has been around a lot, of the genesis of the decision for Boris Johnson to try and, as it were, save Owen Paterson on Tuesday night, which the piece, I think, is headlined a political fiasco. The classic Mail. It's a political fiasco that started over claret and pheasant at the Garrick and ended in humiliation.
Yes, I think that Boris was, well, the dinner at the Garrick was for previous Telegraph, previous and present Telegraph leader writers and other distinguished Telegraph writers. And what Andrew is sort of suggesting is that there are a few of them there, including Charles Moore, perhaps, gave a little bit of ballast to Boris to try and stick his neck out to protect Owen Paterson.
That's a good word for it, Maggie. Ballast.
Ballast, yes, indeed. And what I think this shows us about Boris is how he's very bad at separating the personal with, if you like, professional standards. So he went in headlong to protect Owen, buttressed by, you know, Brexiteers or whatever, the more of the right wing of the party, completely misjudged the mood, but was not able to separate what Owen Paterson had done. And he couldn't see, had no foresight to see what reaction it might have. So what must worry everyone is that where are the people in number 10 who are sitting around and saying, hold on, do you understand what sort of impact this will have? Changing the standards committee is a different issue. Let's, you know, take a step back.
Yeah, if you're being, and I just wanted to.
I was being polite there, by the way.
Yeah, I just wanted to flag up Andrew Pearce saying the group at the Garrick, tucked into fish cakes and pheasant, followed by chocolate souffle at £85 a head, all washed down with a piquant club claret. And I know it's because I began my career on the Sunday Times. Of course, you had to collect these details, so you'd find yourself asking people who had been in key political meetings, well, what colour were the curtains? You know, what sort of wine did they drink? I think it's, there are a number of ways to interpret this, aren't there? And they get absolute kicking. The government gets an absolute kicking from the press, and we'll come to the Times leader, from most of the press, come to the Times leader in a moment, which is very powerful. If you're being slightly generous to Boris Johnson, which not many people are being, I'm not suggesting this, I'm just explaining, as various MPs put it to me, the situation was as follows: that they were seeking to avoid a by-election, partly out of their own self-interest, but also because of the strain on Paterson. And this was a sort of botched attempt to try and rescue him. And if you're being ultra cynical about it, you would say, as Dominic Cummings has done, and we'll draw attention to his Twitter account, which has been very interesting, though I'm not sure whether I buy it or not, on the subject of this week, saying that it's all to do with Boris's own investigations, the investigations that Boris is facing on his own conduct to do with the flat in Downing Street and all that sort of thing. Don't know, just park that thought. But either way, it seems to have been rooted in a misunderstanding of where the contemporary parliamentary Conservative Party is, because it's true that there were about 50 or 60 MPs. That seems to be a pretty good estimate from the MPs I've spoken to. The group of about 50 or 60 MPs who were furious about this, wanted to get the Standards Commissioner, believe that the regime is flawed, and wanted and would see and saw it as the Prime Minister's duty to defend one of their own. But then, of course, as the Prime Minister and the Tory Chief Whip discovered a few hours later, the next day, lots of Tory MPs didn't agree with that. Some of them abstained, and many more voted with heavy hearts, with deep reluctance, with the government on a three-line whip. And then the position became unsustainable. So just two things for me to flag up. Firstly, Fraser Nelson's column in the Telegraph on Friday on all of this, which contrasts quite a bit with the Telegraph leader, which takes a more sympathetic
line, but Fraser's piece is powerful stuff. The Tories are behaving like a tired government in its dying days, he says. Thoughtlessness, arrogance, complacency, being tone deaf to public opinion in the past few days, the Tories have exhibited the traits of an exhausted government in its dying days. And as he says, that's before inflation, which we'll come to in a second, that the Bank of England now expects to eat away and rise in any wages for the next 2 years. So all of that's coming. The difference from the 1990s is that there is no Tony Blair to capitalise, as he says, on these errors. But now as then, it's becoming easier to see how a Tory government ends. And that, Maggie, is what's going to worry them, isn't it? Just this sense that Tory sleaze is back and that the brand is damaged.
Absolutely. And I just, as you were talking there, Ian, I wonder whether Rishi Sunak is regretting not resigning as Chancellor over that budget. Because actually, you know, there is no Tony Blair or Starmer on the opposition, but there could well be decent opposition within the Tory party. But Sunak has sort of balked the line. But if he'd resigned and said, no, I don't agree with this, he would have put himself as the sort of one of the natural successors. Anyways, a little bit. You know, no, I think it's very, it's end of empire, isn't it? And it's sort of inconceivable that they can't anticipate these events. And imagine if they'd allowed the suspension to go ahead. And that's something I think a lot of people don't understand. Why didn't they allow this suspension to go ahead? Paterson could perhaps have pleaded clemency for what's happened over the last year or so. And perhaps the whole event, the issue would have just sort of fizzled out. I know there are issues of recall, but it wouldn't have ended like this.
Shall I explain what I think happened? Yeah. And again, I'm not advocating this position. I'm just seeking to explain what I think they thought they were up to, which is that the 30-day suspension came with the threat of recall, because the way that the legislation is designed, I think it's any suspension over 10 days. Forgive me if it's seven, but I think it's 10. So the 30-day suspension would conceivably leave them open to a process whereby a relatively small portion of the electorate could sign a petition, a recall petition, and there would have to then be a by-election. That was legislation that was introduced because of the last, or one of the last big scandals, which was the expenses scandal, of course, back in 2009. So getting the suspension back to 7 days would have made a difference. But to do that, and this is where they were boxed in by Owen Paterson's attitude that he had done and maintains his innocence throughout and says he has done absolutely nothing wrong, he'd do the same again tomorrow. That closed off that route, because the way to get a 7-day suspension would have been for him to admit that he'd been hazy about the rules and that he'd got carried away, or however he wants to frame it. I think it's very difficult to explain it in those terms, but it's conceivable, and MPs do, when they're caught out on the rules, sometimes admit it and then take the punishment. This isn't the first judgment from the Standards Commission. The Standards Commissioner hears cases all the time and issues usually, slap on the wrist, but sometimes more. So Owen Paterson would have had to admit that he had broken the rules, and then they could have constructed a position which was essentially built on an appeal for clemency, probably whipped a 7-day suspension, and he'd have taken the suspension. But that's impossible, because he decided not to view it that way. Just one other thing to highlight on this: Johnson's shame, the leader column in the Times, declare an interest. I write a weekly column for the Times. The Prime Minister's decision to lead an assault on the integrity of the political system has spectacularly backfired on him, his government, and his party. There's also another thing just to mention, is that this does, and as we're recording this, the Tory Chief Whip Mark Spencer is still in place, but it does shed a light on what's wrong in terms of the Chief Whip's position. It now seems to be, Fraser Nelson mentioned this, and various others have mentioned it as well, is that a year ago the situation was different. Dominic Cummings was perceived to be really running the show. Now Boris is supreme, and as Mark said, he did have a pretty good COP26, if you like that sort of thing, and he is in a strong position politically. So what he says goes. So if he comes back thundering into the office near midnight on a Tuesday or first thing on a Wednesday morning in the morning meeting and says, "That's it, I've decided it's a three-line whip," his word is writ. I think that's what's going on. Shall we move on to another big theme of the week, which may actually in a weird way end up having a greater influence on voters than all of the shenanigans on Parliament? Or just the question I was going to ask you, Mark, is that how much damage does this really do serious damage, or is it just, does it confirm in the minds of voters what they already thought about politicians?
So I think one of the notable features of this is not, you know, a lot of the headlines were Parliament's done itself a lot of damage and politics has brought itself into disrepute. The key thing around this is that this is a Conservative Party event. Yeah. And I do think people understand that. And I think that is why in the Conservative Party, there is real worry. And inside the Conservative Party, the Prime Minister is dominant. Now, this is not controversial or anything to say. He is the dominant figure of his generation. There isn't anybody in the Cabinet or the Parliamentary Party that can challenge him, and they don't challenge him to any noticeable effect, right? At least as far as we know. So I think the party has got to get its head round the fact that it's got to learn how to manage and respond to its leader. Now, we all know Boris really well. Before he became an MP and so on, we've known him a lot, right? Boris is as Boris is. It's not to excuse him or explain him. And I think that the people around him, senior colleagues in Cabinet and the Cabinet Secretary and the Chief of Staff and his PPSs, have all got to work out how they enable him to respond in better ways, knowing how he thinks. And, you know, if he came charging in after a long dinner, he'd just flown down from Scotland, he'd had a big conference, right? The guy's tired. So even if a really powerful Prime Minister walks through the midnight through the door of number 10 and says, "I want X, Y, and Z," they should not just then all leap to attention and head off and, you know, they work out ways. How do they? And I think there's a lot of that is missing. These are all good, capable and able people around him, but they need to work out better how they respond to the Prime Minister, because they keep allowing themselves to, this is really serious, Ian, in my view, because I do think this has cut through. The newspapers have gone absolutely berserk, right, about it. It's completely knocked everything off the, other than Yorkshire Cricket Club, of course, which absurdly has shot itself in the foot, right? So, but I mean, this is a serious thing because it plays into a perception. It resonates, right? It's not the first, is it, in the latest in a series. So I think that there is a serious issue here, and the Conservative Party does not want, because if Boris goes down, the whole party goes down. So they need to work out together how to sort out things better between themselves.
Okay, as I indicated there, we're going to move on to the question of interest rates and what's really going on behind that decision behind the Bank of England, and examine a couple of stories which have grabbed us this week. If you're not a subscriber to Reaction on YouTube, you're watching Press Review, just hit the subscribe button below and like this video if indeed you liked it. Or you can go to the main site, become a member of Reaction, get my weekly newsletter, Maggie's column, Tim Marshall every week on geopolitics, and tons of other
value. Worth every penny. You'll never spend a better buck.
Absolutely. Well said, Mark. So next story we're going to pick through. First pick is from the Financial Times. It's the splash. Bank of England sends investors scrambling by keeping interest rates on hold. So viewers will be familiar with what happened, people in the UK anyway, that it was expected that this week that interest rates would start to rise, because remember, interest rates have been it sounds ridiculous to say historic lows. It's going to be beyond that. I mean, they're basically just, you know, price of money zero, and the plan is to start unwinding quantitative easing, where essentially the central bank buys buys financial assets essentially just to sort of juice the market to keep liquidity flowing and keep the financial system going, and to start to unwind that process and start to raise rates to, as it said, to normalize the economic situation after the crisis, and against the expectations of the markets, as the FT reports, or some of those in the markets, because other people in the markets were saying that they didn't read into the bank's briefings beforehand a guarantee that rates were going to rise. There's some fury. What did you make of it, Maggie?
As you know, a couple of weeks ago, I said what Andrew Bailey was saying to the markets was very confusing.
Yeah,
I think we need to differentiate very clearly. Some investors had thought rates were going up, but if they'd listened, because they were listening to Bailey and also Hugh Pill, the new economist, but actually just about every city economist was saying rates should not go up and they wouldn't go up because for two reasons. One is people were terrified that it might just start tipping confidence and tipping potentially into recession at such a fragile time. And secondly, there are many, and I know you probably disagree with this, Ian, who believe that the inflation, although certainly sharp rate inflation, is transitory. I mean, all inflation is transitory, but it will unwind itself a bit as supply chains and so forth. So, but let's go back to the beginning. Financial markets should be able to take a direction of travel from the Bank of England, and they were clearly misinterpreted it, or Bailey got it wrong. My own view is that he actually got it wrong to start with, and he should have corrected himself and nudged them the other way. Ironically, he got the result he wanted, because money market rates have tightened and all the big banks have put up or got rid of their very low interest rates. So,
I did want to on that score highlight Justin Webb's interview on the Today programme on Friday, which we'll put a link to below, which was just after 10 past 8, where he was interviewing Andrew Bailey. And that it was a very good interview, but it really did just reveal that as a communicator, Bailey is not that clear. I mean, he is in some respects, the quintessential central banker and regulator. But I left it slightly confused. Now, it is a very confusing period. Another thing to highlight would be David Smith's column in the Sunday Times last weekend, where David goes through the projections from the OBR, the projections that the government's essentially using on various bits of scenario planning on inflation. And there is one version in which inflation goes, stays stubbornly high and goes even higher, and you need rates of above 3%, somewhere between 3% and 5%. It's not predicted, but I think, Maggie, it's a possibility there. It might just be a sort of 1 in 10 shot. If that happens, you're looking at a very, very different kind of economic picture next year.
Very bleak
the year
one.
After.
A very bleak one, and you just imagine what
Let's
that's
going
to
happen.
Do.
Yeah. The related story that I wanted to highlight is from Germany, sent to me by a Reaction subscriber, and it's related to this because it's about that process of normalizing the economy and attempting to get rates up and central banks out of QE, or it's crudely called the money printing business. And it's from Gabor Steingart, who was the editor and chief editor of Germany's biggest daily newspaper, Handelsblatt, and he has his own outfit now called Media Pioneer. And it's interesting to see this from, there's no mention of the UK, obviously he's writing primarily about the German and the European economy and the US. And it's headlined "The Self-Crowning of Christine Lagarde." And you hear more and more of this, just particularly the direction which German politics is going, about to have a new finance minister, concerned that as Gabor Steingart says, in the US, they do seem to be on the way to normalizing policy. You know, the Fed laying out plans for how it's going to withdraw from the equity and bond markets. And it's being, as he puts it, it's being deliberated, debated, decided, announced. And there is, as he says, America, the message is returning to normal. He contrasts that with what's happening in the ECB, where there isn't a comparable plan. And it's a real concern for German finance hawks who think that this is just an example of the ECB getting more and more arrogant. As he puts it, the European Central Bank has, and this is the dangerous news of the day, fallen in love with its savior pose. Its monetary policy is shaping the fiscal policy of many countries that could not afford their current expenditures and service their debts without ECB assistance. And he describes it as essentially, conclusion, America and Europe will decouple in monetary policy terms in the coming months of all the economic risks. The lack of an ECB withdrawal plan is currently the most incalculable. Apparently, the central bank wants to continue investing in the production of castles in the air, or to put it another way, stability in the Eurozone is the best stability money can buy. So I thought it was a very interesting newsletter by Gabor Steingart, and sends out a newsletter several times a week. So next story to go to, I think next pick from you, Mark.
Which is Nadine Dorris talking very tough about big tech, actually. And she has revived an approach to a very robust approach, which the government hadn't hitherto pursued. And I think it's interesting because I think Nadine has been a very lively and a big character in Parliament. And I think at one point, maybe people thought Nadine Dorris was going to be one of those huge parliamentary characters, but that never sort of quite sat round a big ministerial table. But I think it's been very impressive to watch her, where she's lost none of that big personality, big character, whilst actually persistently bringing in very interesting and quite tough bits of policy and initiative in the things that she's responsible for. And here she's saying to the big tech companies, if you don't pull your ideas together and sort yourselves out, we're going to take some seriously robust action against you. And I'm very impressed with what she's doing. I mean, she's very fiery on the BBC. Personally, I'm not quite so keen on that because, but she's been very impressive in her track record in government as a cabinet minister in this department. And it seems to suit her, and her ability to communicate is very effective. And she's very effective in Parliament as well. So that's why I wanted to flag this interesting story. And of course, I think that these big media companies, big social media companies, tech companies need to really take this on board, because I don't think she's bluffing.
Interesting.
Good for her.
Maggie, next pick from you.
Okay, my next pick is an interesting piece by Emma Duncan, again in The Times, headlined, "The London Stock Market Needs Life Support." Now, she points out how the London Stock Exchange has, in comparison to the US and Asia, declined in terms of the number of companies coming to list, the capital raising and so forth. And then she, which obviously right now is hugely important that we have a very dynamic, liquid capital market. And she points out, and she rather suggests, I think totally wrongly, that Brexit is one of the reasons why it's sort of losing a lot of these things. She's completely wrong on that. But she comes to some conclusions which we know are being discussed by the Treasury. And that is for to sort of relax the rules, have more dual structures, allow SPACs and so forth. They're the special purpose vehicles where you can list and then you can list, raise money and then go and buy afterwards. But I think actually it's a good subject, and she's sort of right to be pointing out that it is not doing as well as it has done. But I think her conclusions are wrong. And what she misses is that being on a public market today is very tough because of governance issues, private equity. There is so much money, cheap money rushing around, that everybody is delisting and selling to private equity. And that quite the contrary to making it more relaxed. One of the reasons why London's been so good is, apart from a few, you know, money laundering and Russian money coming in, actually our governance is pretty good, and it's taken decades to get rid of dual structures. So she's raised an interesting point which should be debated more widely. Last point, actually the London Stock Exchange has become a data company. It's an information company. And if I were being radical, I might suggest that probably what it needs to do is hive off the London Stock Exchange, the market itself, and start all over again.
Yes, it's an interesting piece, and there are also some really interesting examples of, and this is what happens, and you know, paper like The Times, in the comments section, people are going to dive in, and there's a lot of people who really know their markets commenting on it. And one observation which grabbed me was one reader dating this back really to the, as he puts it, the over-regulation and incorrect share ownership culture that came in with the FCA, which he says, you know, the decline began in 2000, nearly 20 years ago, and talks about the gradual integration of European-based regulations through MiFID I and MiFID II, which, of course, the Brits were central to, and various other technical things. So it charts it as a 20-year story. And Emma does say, she describes Brexit, she says that blames Brexit for some of this. Brexit was a disastrous piece of self-harm with which we are stuck for the foreseeable future. I don't necessarily agree that it was a disastrous piece of self-harm, but anyway, that's a different debate. But she says, but Brexit does at least mean that we have the freedom to change our regulatory system more than we used to, which is interesting. And I think, you know, there has been the reviews that have been conducted into altering the rules, updating them, trying to make London more attractive as a place to invest. And I'm really quite baffled, Maggie, as to why the government hasn't got on and done that.
Yeah, well,
it just seems to be odd. If it is on the one hand, it might be a function of the Prime Minister not being remotely interested in economics, and just thinking, well, the city takes care of itself. But at some point in the next, well, urgently, I would say, you know, next year, they need to turn their attention to this. And I think Emma Duncan's absolutely right. There's a problem there that needs fixing. Maggie, you had a story to flag up as well about COVID and Wales, from Wales Online.
Yes, it was just particularly a well-researched one, but just pointing out from the latest WHO figures, looking at the worrying increase across Europe, where over the last 5 weeks, the number of cases have increased by 50%. And I know a lot of people have been, this is not to sort of compare or to whatever, but it does rather look, if you remember, we had a big surge sort of September, early October, and everyone was sort of saying, oh my God, you know, we're doing so badly and Europe is doing rather well. But it rather looks as though we were sort of ahead of it in some, obviously, because our numbers are now in decline. But what this report, what the WHO report highlights, is that the level of vaccinations across Europe, and particularly in the East European countries and former East Germany, is actually vaccination levels about 47%. And so there's a massive push to try and get vaccinations going. But it is worrying, and their sort of worst case scenario is for another 500,000 deaths across Europe by February. Yeah, I know, not good news at all.
Yeah,
and
but it is this idea that Britain, partly because of early vaccination, is in a different part of the cycle.
Yeah, we're a different part of the cycle. Early vaccinations, our Freedom Day was perhaps more free than some of the European countries. Mm. It's very hard to compare like with like, because if you look at the Scandinavian countries, which are still at low levels, they sort of scrapped all restrictions. But France, Germany and Spain have been particularly strict on sort of mask wearing and so forth. But I think what it shows is it's all very cyclical here, and we haven't beaten it. A bit depressing, really.
Well, a bit depressing. But if you think back to a year ago, just now, vaccination was said to be coming, but people didn't really quite believe it. Mm. The programme didn't, in the UK, didn't start to roll out until January, and the UK and everywhere else in Europe was entering a really tough winter, we have the vaccines. I mean, that is, I know it's been a tough year, but that is a bit of a miracle story, isn't it? We're in a much stronger position than we were 12 months ago.
The Reaction editors there with their weekly pick of global stories and great journalism. I'm Francesca Peacock. This is the Reaction podcast. Until next week, thank you for listening.